everybody. Hey, I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's time for It's All About Food. It's all about food. Thanks for joining me today. It's a lovely April day. And one of the things that I love about spring, well, maybe I don't love it. It's very appropriate, though, right now, because I hear the Mr. Softy truck passing through my neighborhood. And the Mr. Softy truck is filled with dairy products and appealing to all the kids in the playground where I am looking at them from my room. And it's an appropriate thing because we're going to be talking a lot about dairy today, cheese and dairy. So it's kind of humorous to hear that song competing with me right now. I don't know if you can hear it. Well, let's get right to it then. My guest is Dr. Neil Barnard, and he's the author of a new book, The Cheese Trap. He's a clinical researcher, author, and health advocate. He is an adjunct associate professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences and president of the Nonprofit Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Barnard is a frequent lecturer on issues of health, nutrition, and medicine, and is the author of several New York Times bestselling books, including The 21-Day Weight Loss Kickstart and Power Foods for the Brain and The Cheese Trap. I think maybe my favorite. So, Dr. Neil Barnard, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you. It's great to be with you today.
Thank you. Another wonderful, wonderful book. I'm so glad it is out there for people to access. And The Cheese Trap, as you call it, cheese is definitely a trap. The title is so appropriate.
Well,
so
I
just want to jump right into that. Can we talk about the opiates, the addictive nature of cheese? I've been telling people about this program and to listen in, and everyone, as you know, who eats cheese says, oh, I could never give up cheese. And there's a reason for that.
That is right. And it is funny how when the Cheese Trap came out, I was really wondering how people would react, and we seem to really have touched a nerve, because so many people will say exactly what you said. I could never give it up, or I could be vegetarian, but I couldn't possibly be vegan because I wouldn't have cheese. And yet, I think two things that need to be said. The first is, why would you want to get away from it? And the second thing is, why is it so darn hard? And can I tackle that first thing for just a second?
Please.
Because you know, there are things in cheese that people don't know about. To state the obvious, cheese comes from milk. Milk comes from a cow. The cow is pregnant. And people may not think about that. But cows don't give milk until they've been impregnated, and then they give birth. It's about 9 months pregnancy, very similar to humans. And the farmers impregnate the cows every single year, not personally, but they arrange to have them impregnated so that they maximize their milk output. And so 9 months out of 12, the cow is pregnant. Pregnant cows make estrogens, female sex hormones. These estrogens end up in the milk, and they're just traces. But when you turn milk into cheese, you concentrate the fat, and the hormones go with the fat. And still, it's just traces. However, researchers in Rochester, New York, went into a fertility clinic and found that the men consuming the most cheese had the worst sperm counts and the lowest sperm motility and morphology, meaning that there's something about ingesting little traces of female sex hormones that it's not good for guys. It's not good for their fertility. At least we think that's the case. Then researchers in California looked at women who had been treated for breast cancer in the past. Those who ate the most cheese had a 49% higher risk of dying of their cancer compared to the others. And this was terrifying because what it means is these little bits of hormones that we think are innocuous in dairy, even if they are concentrated in cheese, we didn't really expect that the effects would show up in women having a higher risk of hormone-related cancer deaths, men's fertility. And then it starts you to thinking about, well, what if you give this to your child? Well, of course, Americans do give it to their children in very high quantities. And so maybe this hormone interaction is a big issue.
Maybe indeed. So that's number one.
Yes. Number two is Well, there's lots of other things we could talk about, the health effects, but maybe let me cut to what you were talking about at the beginning, which is why do we get hooked on it?
The reason why I wanted to talk about that is because I don't want people to feel bad about having a hard time giving up cheese.
Right. You know, and it's not hard to not eat it. It's an easy thing to eat a veggie burger without the cheese, or to have the bean burrito without the cheese. People can do that. But the issue, so it's not hard, but what they mean to say is, I find myself craving it. And if I haven't had it, it's sort of calling out my name, and I look forward to it. And what's that about? Well, it turns out that there are opiate chemicals in the cheese, and they're produced by the cow, and they're packed into the protein, which is called casein, C-A-S-E-I-N, casein protein, which is in milk but concentrated in cheese. When you digest the protein, these opiates come out, they pass to the brain, and they attach to the very same brain receptors that heroin or morphine would attach to. Only the difference is that they're not as potent as heroin or morphine, and they're not going to make you pass out, but they appear to be just strong enough that the person says, oh, that was nice. Let's do that again tomorrow. Let's have a little bit more. And I don't, you know, so what if I've gained 15 pounds? Okay, well, all right. you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that little devil on your shoulder has a lot more sway over you if the fattening food happens to also be addicting. And so cheese is salt, very high in salt. 2 ounces of cheddar has more salt than 2 ounces of potato chips. It's high in fat, and that salty, fatty part gets us kind of hooked. But I think these opiates are probably the real reason for that addictive quality that it seems to have.
People have such a problem or craving, like you said, with cheese, and it's really important to understand why that is. And especially in today's time, we're living in a really stressful environment. We may touch on politics later because it is connected to the dairy industry, but there's so much going on that's very frustrating. And just that little moment of, that little bit of comfort, I can see where people will reach out for it because times are hard. Now,
yes, but, you know, we may love cheese, but cheese does not love us back, that's for sure.
Yes.
You know, it's... people turn to chocolate and sugar and alcohol and cocaine and all kinds of things for comfort. But cheese, we talked about the hormone effects that are going to hurt you if you're a man or a woman, according to the best science that we have. Stay tuned. There's more to be said, but it doesn't look helpful. It's 70% fat. Cheese and other dairy products are the number one source of bad fat, saturated fat. So read that as heart disease. Read that as Alzheimer's disease. And the proteins that are concentrated in the cheese happen to be the proteins that trigger problems like asthma, migraine headaches, rheumatoid arthritis for many people. So the price that we pay for that gooey, wonderful mouthfeel is huge, and the only reason people have put up with it is they never realized that cheese was the reason that their kids are chubby or that they've got migraine or that they have these health problems. And once they realize it, they've got tremendous power.
You know, you mentioned children being chubby. I know cases where doctors will recommend that children consume dairy and cheese when they're slim to gain weight. And how does that affect them as they get older?
Well, you know, if you're a farmer and you got a steer and you want to fatten up the steer for slaughter, what do? They use hormones in them, and it's perfectly legal to do, and you never thought about the fact, well, if I want my son or daughter to fatten up like a steer, I'll give them hormones. Obviously, one would never do that in a million years, or never want to do that, but that happens to be exactly what we're doing. The average adult consumes more than 60,000 calories worth of cheese every year. I'm speaking just of the cheese. It's about 35 pounds, and I'm not eating any, so someone else is getting 70. But
and I'm not eating any either.
then we got a couple people getting 70 pounds. So the point being, you might think, or people listening to the show might think, what are you talking about cheese? It's just one food. That one food has piled so high in the American diet that I think it's the real reason for the obesity epidemic. And lest someone think that can't be true. all the people listening to this program would probably say, oh, we're eating too much sugar. Isn't sugar the big problem? And sodas and so forth, that's the whole issue. Well, sodas are not health food. But soda consumption, and in fact, all sugar consumption, sweeteners, it's been falling for almost 20 years. Since 1999, we turned the corner on sugar, and it's been less and less and less and less and less. But what's been going up? Cheese. So I really think that's the big issue with regard to obesity.
I'm glad you brought up sugar, because we talk about sugar a lot on this program, and there are some that really believe the addictive nature of sugar is what many people have as a problem. I think sugar is more addicting than cheese, but cheese has its own properties that make it very appealing to many people and hard to kick.
Different people pick different drugs. There are some people who are smokers, and that's their whole thing, and I don't care how many warnings the Surgeon General may give, I just can't live without it. There are others for whom alcohol is their drug. For some people, it's a cup of coffee. For some, it's a Dr. Pepper in the morning. There are people where sugar is their thing, and they are going back and forth to the refrigerator at night. But one thing I would say for people who are having sugar, they never took a box of Domino sugar, poured it into a cup, and ate the whole thing. Mm. When they say they're a sugar addict, what they mean is, I'm eating a sugar cookie. And the sugar cookie has, some of its calories are sugar, but about half the calories come from fat. And that's a real issue, because fat in the cookie adds to your body fat without any conversion. To turn sugar into fat is a challenge for your body. So the fat part of it is a big issue, and cheese happens to be 70% fat. So that's, I think, a big reason why our kids are getting chubbier.
Well, I know a lot of people who listen to this program who are pretty conscious about food struggle with their weight, because I hear from them all the time. So if you're eating cheese, the cheese trap is for you. Now, early in the book, you talk about where cheese gets its, quote, flavor and aroma, and some of it, I haven't had cheese in almost 30 years, but it's really disgusting. And can you talk about some of those bacteria just to whet people's appetite about eating cheese?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. If, let's say you were in college, and you're a freshman in college and never been out of home before, and your roommate starts to have socks that are a little bit ripe because nobody ever taught him to do his laundry, okay? And after 3 or 4 weeks, you say, what, really, you know, what's the deal here? Well, on the human skin, there are bacteria called Brevi bacteria, B-R-E-V-I bacteria, Brevi bacteria. And if a person hasn't washed or whatever, then they get this stinky feet smell. And people say, you know, that cheese is kind of stinky feet cheese. Well, it's not a coincidence. It's the same genus of bacteria. So your Limburger or your Munster is actually treated with exactly Brevi bacteria to make it stink that way. But it gets worse. When a person consumes food and digests food, in their digestive tract, butyric acid is formed by bacterial fermentation. And so if you're a grade school teacher, you have learned the smell when a little child gets upset and throws up on the floor. Vomit has a certain smell. And Parmesan cheese, as it so happens, the bacteria used in fermenting Parmesan cheese happens to create the same butyric acid, which is why it has this kind of vomity smell in the butyric acid in the cheese. But my favorite of all is if you go to Sardinia off the coast of Italy, there is a cheese called Pecorino cheese, and they leave it out and let flies land in it. And the flies lay eggs, and the eggs hatch, and maggots come out, and the maggots start digesting the cheese, and they refer to it as kazu marsu, which means rotten cheese. And you spread it on a cracker, maggots and all, and because the maggots can kind of jump a little bit, what the diner does is take a good slug of red wine, and then they put some of this kazu marsu on a cracker, so the cheese and maggots, and they hold a card up under their nose so the maggots don't hit them in the face, and they then put it in their mouth, maggots and all, and swallow it down. And yes, cheese is one of these.
We are an interesting lot, aren't we?
Well, why is it that this food that everyone admits smells terrible. But then people also are hooked on it, and it's one of these funny paradoxes in the food world.
Yeah, there are a lot of them, unfortunately. Now, you knock down a lot of myths, and we have so many myths in the health world about food. And so one of them you talk about has to do with goats and goat milk, because some people think, okay, cow's milk is probably not too good, so goat's milk, because I've heard the molecule in the goat's milk is similar to human milk, and so it's better.
Well, were that true, then it would be good for your baby, but not for you. I mean, keep in mind, human breast milk was designed for a human baby only up till the age of weaning, and goat milk was designed only for a kid up till the age of weaning, and cow's milk is for a calf up to the age of weaning. Goat's milk has a certain cachet about it, not because it's healthier, but for the opposite reason, because the fat in it is more, it has more of what is called saturated fat in it. It's a little bit more buttery. Plus, people imagine, oh, the goats, they must be on some little farm kind of not too far out of the suburbs, and maybe they treat them better or something like that. From a health standpoint, it is no better. It is probably slightly worse than cow's milk. For the people who care about animals and are concerned about the treatment of cows on farms or whatever, the goats are impregnated every year just like the cows are. The male goats are all killed because they just can't deal with them. And the same is true for cows. The male calves are all killed as well. It's veal. And no civilized person would eat veal. Everyone knows how they're treated, and mm-hmm. most people gave that up a long time ago. The females are separated from their mothers. This is true. This is the only way you get milk, is you impregnate mom, you take away her child so that she doesn't give the milk to child, and then you take it from her. And then the next year and the next year you impregnate her, and then finally, when she's not much use anymore, you send her to slaughter and replace her with her progeny, who then become your milk machines, and you impregnate them and separate their calves or kids away. So no, there's nothing attractive about this industry. In my view, the cheese trap is all about health, but I really felt the need to put in a chapter about what the animals actually go through. For all those 16-year-old kids who don't worry about prostate cancer or rheumatoid arthritis, but do have a heart for animals, for many people that's their biggest motivator.
Well, I know it was my biggest motivator,
Well, that's because you're a civilized person.
Thank you very much.
But you know, I would not be going through all of this if I didn't have a way out. And so the idea of the cheese trap is, yes, I want the first half of the book to get people's attention so they understand there are hormones in it, there's cholesterol, there's sodium. But the second half of the book, I worked with Drina Burton, who is a genius in the kitchen. And she has come up with the best fettuccine Alfredo you ever had. No dairy at all. We have a cheesecake without a drop of dairy. And a little raspberry swirl you can put on the top, it looks beautiful and tastes great. And so we talk about the fun replacement for it. And if you have kids, there are a million ways to engage them in really having fun with their food. And if you're a grown-up kid and you want to try some nice recipes and new product at the store, the cheese trap is full of ways to fuel your adventure in dairy-free eating.
I like it ending on a delicious note, and Drina Burton definitely is a genius. Her recipes are wonderful, and people who are afraid to give up cheese, I like to say you really have no idea what you're missing, because the plant-based cheeses and sauces and creamy spreads are, I think, so much better. And they don't have stinky sock thing going on.
and why not? Take Kite Hill cheese, for example, which mm-hmm. you'll see in all the stores now. Kite Hill uses a regular cheese-making process with cultures, and they'll coagulate in a fairly traditional way. The difference is they don't start with cow's milk. They start with almond milk. Fair enough. You get cheese out of it. But there is no hormone in it. There's no cruelty in it. It's overall a healthier product. There is a brand called Treeline, another one, which Miyoko's Creamery, and there are many others. But they might start with cashews for that kind of creamy flavor. So it is fun to try different ones and see which ones you like. Even so, you don't really necessarily need these foods. They're something to nibble on or to serve at a party, and they are miles ahead of the animal-derived variety. So yeah, I try them. And then also my own secret weapon is nutritional yeast, where mm-hmm. you got kids coming over and we're going to make a pizza, and one kid gets the green olives, and one's got the black olives, and one has the sun-dried tomatoes, and one of the kids has a little jar of nutritional yeast, which has zero fat, but it has a cheesy flavor, and they start sprinkling all these things on the pizza crust, and then they add a little sauce and so forth, and no cheese at all, but you've got a delicious, light pizza that has all the taste and no regrets.
We buy nutritional yeast in the 5-pound bag. That's how much we like
there you
it.
Go. Yeah, exactly. It works really, really well on vegetables and all kinds of stuff. And
before I let you go, I just want yep. to know a little bit about the Bernard Medical Center, which started a little over a year ago. How is that going?
Oh, it's really, really been a fun thing, and we're in expansion mode right now. We started Barnard Medical Center here in Washington, D.C., because we wanted to provide medical care for people where we really focused on the cause of their conditions. So if you've got diabetes or a high cholesterol level or high blood pressure, we can use medicines for those people who do need them. However, because all of these relate to food, we have a team of dietitians, and we have a whole schedule full of classes that people can jump in and take advantage of. And it just has been life-changing. So I have to say the doctors and dietitians and nurses are really happy to be able to work in this environment, but the patients are really happy too. So it's the Barnard Medical Center. We're here in D.C., and my hope is that before too long we'll be able to export this elsewhere.
My hope is that too. I'm glad you're there. I'm in New York, and my little plan probably doesn't include your medical center in it, but it's a model that should expand and people can learn from. So thank you for creating that and everything that you've done, and for writing The Cheese Trap, How Breaking a Surprising Addiction Will Help You Lose Weight, Gain Energy, and Get Healthy. Thank you, Dr. Neil Bernard, for joining me on It's All About Food today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Okay. Take care. Whew. All right, so we have a few minutes before we get on to the second part of the program, and I'm wondering what you're thinking. Do you have cheese cravings? Are you thinking, I could never give up cheese? You need to read this book, okay? And if you have any other questions about how to do it, you're welcome to email me at info@realmeals.org. The book does have some wonderful recipes in it for all kinds of things, sauces and cheeses and Parmesan-like things and creamy desserts. It's wonderful. And we have a few favorite recipes at responsibleeatingandliving.com. We have our cashew cheese fondue and our almond cheese, which is a very, very popular item. You can do it. I know you can. And you're only going to feel better. And one of the things we didn't talk about, but it is in the Cheese Trap book, we use simple words like impregnated. The cow is impregnated. How does that happen? It's not a pleasant process. And it is described a bit in the Cheese Trap. You can Google it and find out how animals, non-human animals, are artificially inseminated. But it is disgusting. It is quite unpleasant, the way we will collect semen from a bull, and then the farmer will put his fist into the cow's anus in order to feel the uterus and then insert the semen to impregnate her. I don't know who thought about this, but it's quite an unpleasant process. And I know for myself, there's like an interesting paradox. A lot of people, when they start to learn about factory farming, for example, wonder about what to give up first. And many people give up cow meat and chicken, and maybe later on might consider dairy and eggs. For myself, I became a vegetarian at 15 years old. And for 15 years, I consumed a lot of dairy and eggs. I would recommend today eliminating dairy first it's a very powerful food and not in a positive way. I know I had advanced ovarian cancer and I contribute some of it. I never contribute cancer being created by one cause. I think it's a combination in many cases. And one of the causes for me was consuming so much dairy for a long time. Not a very good thing. Okay, let's take a very, very quick break. And I want to get on to the next part of the program, which is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to talk about radical self-reliant gardening. We'll be right back. Everybody, how are you doing? Good. Let's move on, shall we? Great. So I'm really excited about this, to bring on my next guest, who I discovered through Chelsea Green Publishing. I really love that house, and I've talked to a number of authors from that publishing company. Will Bonsall has worn many hats since going back to the land, including prospector, draftsman, gravedigger, hobo, musician, logger, and artist, among others. However, he considers subsistence farming to be the only true career he ever had. He is director of the Scatterseed Project, which he founded to help preserve our endangered crop plant diversity. His first book, Through the Eyes of a Stranger, is an eco novel set in a sustainable society of the future. He is also the author of The Essential Guide to Radical Self-Reliant Gardening, Innovative Techniques for Growing Vegetables, Grains, and Perennial Food Crops with Minimal Fossil Fuel and Animal Inputs. Will lives and farms in Industry, Maine, with his wife Molly Thorkesten and two sons. Will, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Karen. How are you?
Good. I really, really enjoyed spending time with your book.
I think you did very well to read it all in the time since I last talked to you. As you notice, it's a pretty extensive, it's a pretty long thing. You could have done War and Peace in half the time, perhaps, eh?
It is dense. It is intense. I took a lot of notes. And I like to think that one day, I live in New York City, in an apartment building with a terrace. But, you know, there is a part of me that longs to grow food. And if that ever does happen, your book is going to be right there with me, guiding the way.
Well, I hope you find something useful in it.
Thank you. There's so many interesting things to talk about, especially from a book of 400 pages. but let's just start with simple concepts that you talk about, like eco-efficiency, which you mentioned you thought you had come up with, but then found others use the same term with similar definitions. And I want to connect that with permaculture and organic gardening, because I know my listeners are interested in that. Can you riff on that?
Yeah, you bet. Those are two very interesting comparisons and contrasts you're making, because they both are similar but different. And I would, knowing what I think of the mix of your radio audience, I would point out in the very beginning that one of the things that's distinct about my, quote, my veganism is it is not primarily predicated on what I call bunny hugging or compassion or ethical, you know, things like that. Although I have, those are all totally good reasons. I don't know of any bad reason to be a vegan. But I tend to avoid ideology, per se, in my writing, particularly in that book, because I'm trying to appeal to people who are... I like to not just preach to the choir. And one of the arguments, in fact, my main argument initially for going vegan and veganic in my farming system, not just what I eat, but what I how I grow what I eat, thing that you refer to is eco-efficiency, the fact that it is simply unecological, unbusinesslike. I always like to refer to that, because an awful lot of people are, we tend to be, I think, sometimes some of us rather cynical, and we're not too moved by someone saying this is some unethical thing. But we like to think that we're all sensible, reasonable, irrational people. And when someone points out that this is irrational, why, that appeals to something a little more visceral, I think. And that's what I'm trying to do. So you make the analogy or comparing it with organic. One of the points, as you found in my book, that I emphasize is I initially started off my working career in the mining business, prospecting and so on, and I didn't like it. It's a rather dirty business, and I got out of it. I wanted to get into something more recycling, and what could be more recycling than organic farming? But hardly get into it, I started hearing and reading about, well, if you use so many tons per acre of phosphate and lime and all these things, and all these things that are mined somewhere, and I had to ask myself, I thought I'd get out of that business. Why is that so crucial to organic farming? And so my book, among other things, deals with some of those issues of how to avoid be a farmer without being a miner. And you also referenced the permaculture thing. And again, even though I see a true permaculture system is really the ideal of sustainable agriculture, a sustainable food system, the way usual method I hear, the usual techniques I hear applied to permaculture basically involve growing a lot of things to feed to an animal and then eat the animal. And to me, that basically kind of nullifies the main advantage of permaculture, of not tilling and not having to have bare ground and all that kind of stuff. But then when you put that stuff through an animal, then you lose so much of the efficiency of it, like 90%. You're throwing away. So I just don't get it. I think there is something that's more organic than organic, and I think there's something that's more permaculture than permaculture. And those are the things I'm trying to aim at and discussing a lot in my book.
I have a thing with the word efficiency, and often I don't like when it's used, because a lot of industry, for example, will use efficiency to obtain certain goals, and they'll support efficiency in their terms. And efficiency is not always the best thing, especially when people's livelihoods are at stake.
I think efficiency, really efficiency, always is the best thing. It's just that we often call things efficient that are not really the things that you're referring
exactly.
to. There's you have to look at the bottom line, and again, that's one of the things in my book. I try to make sure we're looking at the real bottom line. When we say that this makes sense or doesn't make sense, it's often because we're not allowing for the externalities in it, and that's the very thing you're referring to. So for that same reason, I sound very crassly pragmatic and am about, yes, we want efficiency, real efficiency, bottom line efficiency, not just something that has the appearance of being efficient.
Yeah, well, the appearance of being efficient means the highest profits at any cost.
Exactly. And that may not be real profit. That may be like short-term profits or not unsustainable profits. And again, that's not good business. That's not real efficiency. We disguise an awful lot of things in our lives, in our civilization, under this mantle of, and the marketplace allows us to do a lot of that. And the other thing that allows us to do it is this ocean of petroleum underneath us. That a lot of things that appear to be efficient that are not efficient at all, that really would, in a quote, real world, after petroleum especially, just won't work anymore. This thing that we call civilization that we've been doing for, few thousand years, looking at the big picture, we really have to ask questions like, is this civilization really a sustainable thing, or is it just flash in the pan? Is it here today, gone? Well, what's 1,000 years? What's a couple of 1,000 years? It's nothing. How long can we keep doing this without undermining our base?
That is the question, isn't it? one of the big concepts that I really enjoyed early on, and I don't think I've ever thought of it this way, but this rather than, well, the real sustainability is this cycle that you talk about, where we grow crops, we eat them,
exactly.
So we're taking, and then we put all of that right back in the same place. We're not mining somewhere else and grabbing stuff from somewhere else. We're keeping everything right in that same place. Beautiful.
Round and round, round and round. If we do have to import something into the system, there are some things, certain trace minerals, for example, that simply are not there for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Maybe we do have to bring them from somewhere else. But should we have to every year, bring in so many, sometimes tons per acre of this or that? To me, that's mining, and it's not really sustainable, and it's not really organic.
That's right, but we're not there yet. Now, you talk about this imaginary futuristic society.
Oh, now you're in the other book now.
No, you did it in this book.
Well, that's right. I did reference it because it was sort of my take off my point of reference. You know, what about a place called Hesperia? Yeah, thank you. That's right.
Yeah,
sure,
it's there. I mean, it makes me want to read the other one, but I love the idea of having an image of what life could be like, because I feel that when we imagine it, we can ultimately make it so.
You can't build anything without a blueprint first. You have to have, even if it's just simply in your head or lines on a paper, you can't start the real building business until you have to have the vision. And the main thing that novel proposes or offers is a vision, no ultimate the vision, but a one of any number of possibilities for a sustainable civilization. Actually, you haven't read that book, but what purports to, there's a great paradox in it, what purports to be the protagonist of the story, the fellow Yarrow, and what happens to him and so on, is really just the backdrop. It's the context for the story. What appears to be the context of the story, the land of Hesperia, is in fact the protagonist. That's the real character, is this world.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I want to read it. Is it 400 pages?
No, it's a little bit shorter. Actually, it's 365, I think, although it's the size of a novel size, not just big pages. And
okay,
incidentally,
so you
and
cover,
just in,
you
incidentally,
cover...
there's a sequel to it, which I am just finishing almost as we speak. I'm just putting the finishing touches this last couple of weeks on a sequel to that. The two together are called the Yarrow Tales. I call it a bilogy as opposed to a trilogy. And the first one, the one that's referenced in the book, is called Through the Eyes of a Stranger. The sequel is called In the Larger House. And the reasons behind those titles are alluded to in the book when one figures out what they're called. But yeah, it's basically a possible vision of a sustainable, which incidentally is vegan. Yarrow's adopted nation of Hesperia, they're vegans, maybe partly because of compassion and that kind of stuff, but they basically need to maintain an advanced civilization on a finite footprint, a large enough population to be able to defend themselves and so forth, and yet without undermining their base.
Well, you'll have to let me know when that's out, and we'll have to talk about that on another program.
That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you have so much knowledge, and you've built so many different things on your land. You cover everything from equipment to seeds to recipes to growing, nurturing the soil, so many different topics. When were you born into this?
But far from it. No, I was raised about less than an hour from here, where I am, in Waterville, Maine, a mill town. My dad was a mail carrier, my mother was a telephone operator, and no, we had a small garden, but no, I cannot say I was part of the back to the land movement, because like most of that movement, I was not going back to the land. I was going back to something I never came from.
Okay, so you just kind of figured this all out over the decades.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. It took me a lot longer than it would take most people, because being a guy, I don't ask questions. I don't do research. I just figure it out. I know all about how to do that, and then I do it two or three times, and eventually I figure it out. So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, sometimes that's a great way to learn.
Well, I won't say it is. It's just the way I do things. It's not at all the way. I don't advocate it at all. But you commented how the wide range of the book, the gardening book. That's all the fault of my editor. When they approached me, they told me they had this idea for, they thought I'd like to do a book. They particularly were thinking I might do a thing on grain growing, since I'm known for small-scale grain growing. And sure, I could do that. And then what about this other thing you do, farming without manure? And yeah, I could do that. And went on and on. I threw out some ideas, and everything I said, yeah, they gave me carte blanche to write a book about everything I know and then some. And that's what you got.
All right, let's talk about veganics and gardening without manure and humanure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Please. What
will we talk about it?
I want to know.
You start. You take you lead the direction, and I'll follow this one.
Okay, sounds good. Okay. Now, I've talked to a number of people who do veganic gardening, and I learned from some that it came out of necessity, not really any concern about animals. They were just in a location where they didn't have animals, so
Very
they learned how to nourish the soil without animals.
I know it's quite a few people that that's exactly it. In fact, some of them are meat eaters, but they just find out they live in the suburbs or something. They don't have access to animal manure, but they have grass clippings and they have leaves and things like that, the exact components of my system. Yeah, that's a very good point.
But there are many people who just can't fathom that. They believe that it's all part of the romance of nature, how we need to have animals on our property.
Oh, yes.
And there's one more thing here, because it always kills me. I think, okay, if you think you need to have the animals and you need to have their shit, excuse me, why do you have to kill them?
Well, sooner or later you would. I'll be devil's advocate here. If you're going to keep animals, and because some people have thought they could, for example, initially when I first came here, I was not eating meat, but I was going to have dairy goats. And, oh, how do you have goats? You're going to have surplus nannies. You're going to have old goats, you know, the dried up goats and so on. Somewhere along the line you have to deal with, or someone else has to. And that's again, my key focus is looking at the bottom line. Simply sloughing a problem off to someone else is not really solving the problem. So that's when I started realizing that, no, there's got to be a way of doing it without those things. And right along with it came the question of manure. What about the doo-doo? And that was when I first started realizing the doo-doo does not amount to much in terms of fertility. It's the mantra of organic gardening. You know, a cow pies is what makes the world go around. But, in fact, animal manure, as the book explains in some detail, is ultimately not a source of fertility at all. The fertility ultimately comes from the plants, the hay, and the grain and stuff that the animal ate. And the manure is simply a byproduct of someone else killing and keeping and killing and eating animals. And in terms of building the soil, conventional organic gardening, by which I mean using livestock manure, doesn't actually build the soil at all. It barely tries to maintain the soil. But the only things, the way Mother Nature does it, is by the use of primarily forest, either grassland, prairie, grassland, or where there's enough water, forest. This is the ultimate eco-efficient system. This is a system which produces so much more bounty in one form or another, whether directly as food or as food for the food, produces so much more than it itself requires. And so if you really want a system that really, the bottom line is the big fat profit, then you really need to be looking at plants, not only on your table, but also to maintain the soil. And grass and particularly leaf forest residues, particularly leaves and chips and stuff, are really right where it's at.
I liked where you told many stories and you have a great sense of humor, and you also talked about how your editor took out some of your humorous anecdotes. And maybe
very little.
You want to share one that wasn't in the book here.
She was very indulgent. If she hadn't taken out some of them, it probably would have been banned in Boston. But they let most of it, some pretty cheeky remarks and stuff, quips I made there that they let pass. They say they're a wonderful publisher to deal with. They say we're trying not to muzzle our author's voice, and I can tell you that's true. They did. They didn't muzzle me really at all.
Well, I liked the concept of seeing value in someone else's garbage. And there are lots of ways to do this here in New York City. We have the freegans, we have the dumpster divers, people who grab things that are thrown away. Sometimes it's food, sometimes it's furniture, and they see value in someone else's garbage. And I've seen it too with compost or kitchen waste, throwing it away when it could become compost. And you talked about an elderly woman's leaves that you used to take from her.
The Austrian lady, yes.
Yeah. I mean, leaves, they're not garbage. I can't stand when I see people raking them and throwing them away because their ground right there needs them.
When I was a kid, we burned them. Everyone raked them in the ditch and burned them. Yeah, that's a very good example, because that woman herself, she did value them. She wouldn't let me have her leaves because she had a use for them, very good, basically what I was doing with it, and which I used. That was one of a couple examples I used to overturn the conventional wisdom that leaves don't have much value, not much fertility in them. And her whole garden was based on leaves and nothing else. And so from that point of view, and mine too, the leaves almost are not a waste product. They're a primary harvest, and then the food that grows from them whichever way you want to go with it, is the ultimate harvest for me. So it's a very different situation when people in urban areas, you have essentially a salvage ecology, where they're scavenging, like you say, taking whether it's the residues or old furniture, any of these kinds of things, which generally came from outside of the, let's say, the metropolitan limits or something, were brought in there, and they're keeping it circling round and round. So they're functioning somewhat like mushrooms of people in that situation. We're taking what's already there and keeping moving it around, which is very good for people in that situation. That's the only choice you really have, or it's the best choice you have. In my situation, I'm out where I have lots of those resources. I have all, I could be keeping animals and growing meat and milk and all that, but I just find a much more efficient, frankly, an easier way of doing the whole thing. And that's my compelling thing. I try to emphasize that because I'm not trying to appeal to, I'm not trying to preach to the choir. I'm not trying to appeal to people's higher motives. I'm trying to appeal to their crasser instincts. Geez, this is easy. I'm lazy. I don't want to do all that work. It works. You can laugh at that, Karen, but it works. I managed to reach a lot of people who were not vegan and maybe go ahead and leave me still not being vegan, but do something that's a whole lot better than what they were doing before. It's appealing to them wherever they're at, not where I am or where I think they should be.
So let me ask you, you obviously have time to write. How much free time do you have?
Very little. In the wintertime, the last few years have been particularly difficult because I was first doing that the novel, and then this last book you're referring to, and then this winter trying to wrap up the sequel to the novel. And I also do articles regularly. They do take quite a lot of time. They're the main thing I do for money, actually. My own contribution to the household budget is mainly from writing and speaking, which, if you haven't noticed, I do a lot of that, and very fast and so forth. If I could get paid for words per minute, I'd be quite wealthy. But anyway, those are the things that I do as outreach, and I'm basically selling virtually nothing. There's very few of the things that I grow. They're primarily for my own consumption. And incidentally, that puts me in a kind of unique situation because the person who the farmers, we have a lot of market gardeners around here and CSAs and stuff who produce food and send it off to the market. And as I emphasize in the book, that is one of two, and perhaps not even the second one, sources of erosion. One is stuff leaching, washing away, but the other one is the food sent off to the marketplace. Well, of course, we don't think of that. We don't think of that as erosion. That's what we're doing it for. And yet, when you think of the tons per acre of calcium, potassium, phosphorus, and nitrogen, all these things that get sent, and they ain't never coming back. I mean, long ago, before we had this marvelous invention called the flush toilet, there was a sort of a given symbiosis, kind of a compact between the country and the urban areas, because the urban areas weren't so big, but what usually wherever you ate that stuff and pooed it out, someone collected it, recycled it, and went back to the fields, which were probably within a couple miles of the center of the village or something. And we broke that cycle. We broke that contract with the earth when we got the flush toilet. That stuff goes away somewhere. The best that happens with it, it doesn't get back to the land that produced it.
There's a lot that's broken in this society, no question about that. And even when we evaluate the gross domestic product, we don't consider the value. You talk about this towards the end of the book, the value of the food that you're producing on your land. It has no value. I mean, it has tremendous value. And I want to grow food because, you know, there's a part of me that doesn't trust what's going on in the world. And I think there may be a time where it'll be difficult to get food. And for those who can grow it, you're the richest people around. But
well,
it's kind of a
happy irony for me is that I grow a very large percentage of my food, but certainly not all of it. A lot of people say that we grow all our own food here, and we don't. Other people that I've heard say they do, they don't either, if you look at everything. But I do grow a disproportionately large amount of my food, particularly the expensive parts of it, fruits and vegetables and so on, and some of the grain and legumes and stuff. And you know, every time when I'm right now in the middle of doing my tax form ready, and there's no line on my 1040 form for the value of the food that I grew and ate. I can't put it down. If I wanted to put it down, so I can't pay taxes on it because I'm both the producer and the consumer, the middleman and everything.
I want to jump around now. There's, you know, it's the Jewish holiday of Passover this
right.
week.
Yes, exactly.
And I'm not a religious person. You mentioned you're an atheist. I am also someone who does not believe in a higher authority. And you were talking about alliums. And we all love when onions and garlic are frying. You were talking about that. And then I just want to read here, just as how we are addicted to the flavor of alliums, is reflected in the story of the Exodus. the people of Israel are trekking around the Sinai, haven't recently escaped from a land where they endured slavery and genocide. Does anyone say, hey, guys, this manna stuff really hits the spot? No, they keep kvetching about how much they miss the onions and garlics and leeks they had back there. And then, of course, in the Ayurvedic, you continue tradition, India, garlic is something not to be eaten, onions and garlic, in the Jain society. I just found that humorous, and I thought it was appropriate to mention.
Well,
I think
I mentioned in there, supposedly the alliums are not conducive to spiritual development. And it
says
that proves it. See, I eat them all the time, and I'm an atheist. Yeah, they nailed that one.
I love onions and garlic and leeks, especially when they're cooking.
You know, as you ever notice, but I certainly notice, almost any time you come into a room or someone else comes into the house or something, and whenever you hear the comment, oh, something smells really good, it seems to be always one of two things. It's either onions or garlic frying, or it's something yeasty, bread breaking, some sweet, you know, cake or dough or something like that. Those things seem to be highly evocative smells, flavors. It seems like even if we're cooking something that we really may love to eat, the smell of it doesn't seem to quite get our juices going, quite like those alliums.
Right. So I always love when I discover new things, and I wanted to talk about some of those things. You talk about using oil meal and using it instead of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about what that is
and
how it works?
Well, I mean, basically there are the oil seeds, basically those crops that we grow to press oil from them, like cottonseed, canola, sunflower seeds, sesame, all those things that are grown like industrial-scale agriculture, and press you. And we use the oil to fry things, to make mayonnaise and dressings and things like that. And fairly early in the game, we were very serious about this, growing our own food. And we said, okay, what about the oil? That's, you know, all the people that think they're being so self-reliant because they're growing their mesclun mixes and their salsa ingredients, you know, and buying all their grain and, you know, all that kind of stuff. We want to really do this, so what about oil? And we tried growing a few things, canola, and we tried growing sunflower seeds, thinking to press oil from them. Well, at that time, we didn't have anything. We have since, but we did not have any technology to press the oil from them. We just went ahead and started on it, not knowing how we were going to continue it. And when we realized that it wasn't practical to do that, then it occurred to us, geez, this stuff has got the oil in it already, the sunflower seeds. Now, there's all this other stuff in the seed, too. All this protein and calcium and silicon and a lot of trace minerals in oil seeds, you know, fluorine and things like that. And so if we were to press the oil from this and eat the oil, which is the one part that our body can synthesize its own oil, and then take all that other stuff and feed it to a stupid mammal, a pig or a goat or something, and where is the sense in that? So what if we were to eat, since we're so much into whole foods, then instead of eating this extracted oil, what if we were to use the seed in its whole form? And so for years, we developed a whole cuisine of making, for example, something sort of like mayonnaise, using whole ground-up sunflower seeds, not pressing the oil, but the whole seed, and fermenting it to make a kind of a smetana, like a sour cream kind of a thing, and all kinds of things like that. If we wanted to fry pancakes, instead of putting a tablespoon of oil on the pan, well, get it with a cast iron pan, get it real hot first, and then sprinkle a little bit of ground-up sunflower meal on it, and real quickly, because it starts scorching wicked quick, put the batter on top of that. Well, then you end up with your pancake all crispy fried like it would have been in oil, but it has this coating of not just oil, but the toasted, not the seeds, the oil, nuttier flavor, and of course, all the nutrition is there. You're not throwing away the most valuable part of it. So, yeah, we get into that very much. In more recent years, we've become backslid in some ways so that we do use more oil than we used to, but we still, from time to time, get our act together and revert back to using, as much as we can, using the seeds whole. Canola, we can grow canola here easily, but it is not. If you're going to use canola oil, you do have to extract it. So the canola seeds we had were not useful for oil seed, but we had tons of it, so we played around with it, and we discovered that, well, we could grow sprouting these seeds, and they were very delicious, not as an oil seed, but as a winter vegetable, sort of. So, yeah, we had a lot of go around and round with trying to grow our own oil, and we came up with a lot of very interesting things as a result of the effort.
Yes, I always like to say when you restrict something, you get really creative and your world expands.
Exactly. That and so many other things had that effect again and again with us. Likewise, trying to avoid animal manure, we found so many other things that were very serendipitous. We'd find something that was much more valuable than the thing we were trying to do in the first place. Sometimes failure can be delicious.
Okay, we have 3 minutes, and I have like 25,000 things I want to talk about, but I can't.
Okay, you got a second for each one, then. How's that?
Okay, so I want to talk about humanure, and I want to talk about gardens without borders.
Okay. To start, first of all, with Gardens Without Borders, that was the original working title for the book, by the way. And what it ended up with, I'm very I love everything about the book except the title. But when it was all done, the publisher came up with this objection, a totally valid one. She said, Gardens Without Borders, well, it's catchy and all that, but the person will wonder, what does it mean? And I said, well, as soon as they open the cover in the very first paragraph, it's spelled out really clearly. She says, yes, but that's too late. When they're standing in the aisle at Barnes & Noble, they've got to, it's got to get them right away before that. They'll never get to opening up. So they came up with this idea, Will Bonsall's Essential Guide to blah, 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 whatever. And I wasn't happy at all with it. I'm not at all happy with the title. But she was right. What had been the working title was not adequate. I think we should have come up with something that's a little different. But the whole idea behind it is, as summed up in the very beginning, is, again, don't, when you're thinking about your garden, don't just think about that bit. When you look beyond the edges of your garden, I say, I assure you it's a mirage. There are no boundaries, borders to your garden. It just goes on and on and on in every sense. I mean, ecologically, economically, politically, whatever. I mean, everyone, the chairman of the board and the priest and the president, everyone is sitting right in the middle of your garden. All these forces in the society that are, you've got to deal with all of them. So don't just think of your little garden as some kind of an entity. It's a part of a much bigger thing. As for humanure, it kind of ties in with the same thing. We don't use animal manure because since we're not keeping animals, where would we get the manure? We'd have to bring it from somewhere else, and we're trying to avoid a system that brings stuff in from outside. But as long as we're here and as long as we're eating, we're going to have our manure. And we live out in the country where we have a privy. We don't have a septic field or a municipal sewage system. Otherwise, it would be a very different story. But since we are generating this stuff anyway, it occurred to us this stuff is really, really precious. This is far from being a waste product. Human beings eat better than probably any other species on Earth. We eat richer, more richer stuff, and it's got to reflect in our waste. And so even though our manure, our own feces, could never be enough to drive the system, in terms of building our soil system, it's fairly insignificant. It is, if you'll pardon the expression, a drop in the bucket, or not even a drop in the bucket. So on the one hand, it's not enough to drive things. We're really counting on the hay and the leaves and all that stuff. But on the other hand, it is far too valuable that 4 to 6 or 8 wheelbarrowfuls a year of finished composted humanure is far too valuable to waste. So I'm very glad.
Okay, Will, we're out of time.
There we go. That was fun.
It was fun, and all of this is so fascinating, and we have so much more to talk about. I really am sincere. I want to hear when your next book is out, and we can talk more about that. Thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, Will, and I invite everyone to check out your Essential Guide to Radical Self-Reliant Gardening and Gardens Without Borders. Thank you. Well, we're at the end. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you've been listening to It's All About Food. Find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Write me at info@realmeals.org, and have a delicious week. Bye-bye.